Hi, good morning, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Janice Butchko, and I'm from the MDS Foundation, and I also have Leah Harrison here. And we also have, we're partnering with Leukemia Lymphoma Society today. So we have Stacy Kreisman here, and she'll be speaking later on. If you need anything during the course of the day, please find us, and we'll help you in any way we can. It's a casual atmosphere, so if you need to get up, take a break, feel free. The bathrooms are right outside around the corner, and we will be audio taping the meeting this morning, so if you could please speak into the microphone when you have questions. And I want to thank you to Dr. Shar from the Rutgers Cancer Institute. Today, he'll be starting off, and Dr. Goldberg from the John Thera Cancer Center at Hackensack University Medical Center. And we also like to thank our industry partners, Celgene, Novartis, Takeda, and Agios, as well as our generous private donors for making these educational programs possible. We're going to start off with Dr. Shar, so I'll hand it over to him.
Okay, very good. You guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Let's see if I can get this going.
Oh, is it off?
No, it's all tab. Right, it looks good. It looks good on the screen. Yep. I think it's okay if that's all right. All right. As my name is Dale Shar. I'm one of the hemalignancies and bone marrow transplant attendings at the Rutgers Cancer Institute in New Jersey, just down in New Brunswick. Very much happy to be here today to talk about myelodysplasia. I'm sort of an informal person. So if you have questions during the talk, feel free to, you know, get my attention, and we can, as long as we can keep the talk sort of going. And at the end, I'm sure there'll be time for questions, okay? I want to thank also the MDS Foundation and also the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society for inviting me here today with Dr. Goldberg to help shed some light on this very complex spectrum of diseases. All right, so my talk today is sort of a mixture of really patient-directed slides, that some of them which came from the LLS slide bank, and some of them are my own, and sort of mixed together so we can get a sort of a comprehensive overview of what myelodysplasia is. And also the MDS Foundation, I'll just a little just advertisement here, I just thieved this from their website. It's a very important source of information for patients, and their mission statement is up here, and then followed by the Leukemia Society's mission statement. Both are stellar organizations and are there to help everybody sort of manage their progress and treatment through these very complex diseases. All right, so we're going to try to cover a lot in this introductory talk. I know Dr. Goldberg is going to talk about the more higher level things like bone marrow transplant and clinical trials. I may touch on some of that at the end, depending on how much time is left. I have a lot of slides. I may move quickly at times, so if it's too fast, just let me know. If you know you can't hear me or anything like that, just raise your hand, and we'll take care of it. So there's a lot of topics to cover. What is MDS? What are MDS syndromes? What are the signs and symptoms? How is it diagnosed? The different subtypes of MDS, how we sort of prognosticate it, how an individual may do or what treatment they may require at what time is sort of based on a certain score that one gets based on their presenting characteristics. And then we'll go through treatment and follow-up. So it all starts about the bloodstream, right? The blood system. So your bone marrow is essentially a factory for your blood cell formation throughout your lifetime. And now this is accomplished by the existence of blood stem cells or hematopoietic stem cells that when we take these stem cells out and put them into another individual, they can totally recapitulate one's a hematopoiesis, or their developmental system of blood cell formation. And normally, your blood consists of several different blood types. I'm sure you guys have heard this before, but just in terms of a review, the red blood cells are the cells that carry oxygen in your body. So if your red cells are low, you may feel a little bit more tired, may have trouble breathing because your tissues are not getting enough oxygen due to the low red cells. White cells are the infection-fighting cells, and there's all different types of white cells. So myelodysplasia, for the most part, involves the white blood cells that are involved in protecting you, like right now. So the granulocytes, the segmented cells that gobble up bacteria right in real time. The other segment of or category of white cells are the lymphocytes, and they're the more smarter white cells, the ones that react to vaccination and remember what infections they've seen in the past. Excuse me. And then the final component is the platelets. And platelets are very important too because they're the type of cells that are required to stop bleeding when you cut yourself or when you get a bruise. But actually, it happens 24/7. Your blood vessels are constantly having little microscopic leaking events, and your platelets run to that site and sort of plug up those defects all the time. So platelets are the type of blood cells, like white blood cells, are constantly used and consumed. So if your platelets go down, and your bone marrow is not able to produce an adequate a number of platelets, the amount of platelets you'll have is circulating in your blood will continue to go down unless you get them replaced. And so people always say to me, well, you know, I just got platelets yesterday or 2 days ago. How come my platelet count is down to 10,000? If they're not being replaced, they are being constantly consumed. So your platelet count is sort of will go down with time because they'll be utilized by the body. And the plasma is just the liquid part of the blood. That's everything that's not cellular. So that's the water that your body needs. It carries the vitamins, minerals, proteins, hormones, and other chemical signals that the body elaborates. So what's myelodysplasia or myelodysplastic syndromes? So myelodysplasia, MDS, sort of interchangeable terms for the same disease. And as it's described up here, MDS is a disease of the blood and bone marrow that results when the stem cells or the blood-forming cells are damaged. So MDS is a spectrum of diseases that is derived from a stem cell, a hematopoietic stem cell, that somewhere along the way incurred some damage and now no longer functions normally. So if you have MDS, it's caused by this damaged stem cell, and it may manifest initially as maybe just anemia, red blood cells being low. You may have just low platelets or thrombocytopenia, or you may have involvement of different cell lineages. But it's a stem cell disease, and that's why later on we'll talk about that a bone marrow transplant is able to cure this disease in a certain number of people because we're replacing that damaged stem cell with one that's functioning normally. So I get this question a lot. Is MDS, is it cancer? And the answer is yes, it is cancer. But it's not a cancer that's so hyper-aggressive like acute leukemia, right? And some people, I could say actually in most patients that are diagnosed with MDS, there's sort of a natural history. And people may stay at certain stages for certain periods of time depending on what characteristics they have when they present. Acute leukemia is sort of the end, it's sort of the final stage of myelodysplasia in terms of its progression. And that's acute leukemia is a medical emergency for the most part. And people that get acute leukemia just de novo or from scratch, I mean, they usually need medical attention like right away. People with myelodysplasia, for the most part, sort of have a smoldering, more of a, at least initially, chronic course based on, again, what characteristics they have when they present. And it's caused by, as I mentioned, a mutation in their stem cell that sort of prevents that stem cell from filling out each of the blood lineages appropriately. And I guess that's really the take-home point is everybody's myelodysplastic syndrome may be a little bit different, you know, and in the beginning, really, it's usually most appropriate just to watch and wait. Treatment is sort of based on when somebody needs to be treated, whether that's in 1 month, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. You need to be watched, and when treatment is needed, that's when, you know, you discuss with your doctor the different options. And I'll go over that in a lot more detail in a minute. So who gets myelodysplasia? So a lot of diseases and medicines, you know, get more prevalent as one gets older. And myelodysplasia and other myeloid diseases like acute myeloid leukemia or AML, they're more prevalent as you get older. So acute leukemia essentially comes in two different varieties. You know, ALL, or acute lymphoblastic leukemia, is more a disease of kids. It's more prevalent in children, but adults can get it also. AML, or acute myeloid leukemia, which is what a certain percentage of myelodysplastic patients will develop over time, is a acute leukemia that's more prevalent in adults. In fact, the median age for somebody to get AML is somewhere around 65. MDS sort of mimics that because it's also a problem with the myeloid compartment. And so the incidence may be only 4 per 100,000 people overall, but as you can see, it increases to greater than 30 individuals per 100,000 once you get over the age 70. So it really is associated with aging. The prevalence seems to be increasing, and it's unclear to us whether this is due to environmental exposures or if it's due to our ability to pick up the disease earlier and in more people. So in the end, it's probably a combination of those two things. And it's more common in males, and it's more common in smokers. I haven't seen many things, if anything, that's favorable that's associated with smoking, so that's something that everybody should sort of avoid. So this is just a graphical presentation of the data that I just went over. And as you can see, when you get over 80, this number gets to be up to like near 55 per 100,000 people. And less than 40, it's less than 1 or 2 per 100,000 people. So as you get older, the incidence of myelodysplasia increases. All right, so what are the risk factors for myelodysplasia? Because, you know, you meet individuals when they're first diagnosed and you say, you know, what happened? You know, I can't understand that I came down with this disease. Most of the time, we do not have a good explanation why one will develop myelodysplasia. But there are a few triggers that are well known. And probably the most important is previous treatment for a previous cancer. So people that got treated for breast cancer, adjuvant therapy for breast cancer, or had colon cancer, and had received either chemotherapy or radiation, they're at a higher risk for developing myelodysplasia. And you know, it's unfortunate, but you know, you have to get rid of the first cancer initially. But a certain percentage of those people will have incurred damage from that chemotherapy in their stem cell that will manifest as myelodysplasia later. And depending on what chemotherapy you required, there's different latency before we would expect to see myelodysplasia. So after radiation, it's usually on the order of years. These type of drugs that are usually associated with, you know, treatment with maybe adjuvant treatment of breast cancer or even lymphoma, their latency is shorter. It's usually less than, it can be as quick as 6 months. Usually it's around 2 years. You can also get this class of medicines that are chemotherapy agents for other diseases that aren't cancer, and that's essentially, you know, the rheumatologic or autoimmune disorders like lupus or ulcerative colitis or Wegener's vasculitis. These type of diseases, you may have had to take things like oral cyclophosphamide or different chemotherapy agents like that at a low dose for a long period of time, and that may provoke mild dysplasia in the future. And there is some data for environmental toxins, and they're similar to what we would expect from somebody that develops acute leukemia, particularly AML, and that's people that have a very high exposure history to heavy chain hydrocarbons, aromatic hydrocarbons like benzene, toluene, these type of things. Not so prevalent in the workplace nowadays because their dangers have been elucidated. Yes?
Is there any data from the World Trade Center catastrophe relating benzene to the blood cancers?
Well, benzene is definitely associated with developing leukemia. You know, that's the stereotypic story I'll get is, you know, an older gentleman that worked as a tool maker and or in the Navy, and they had to clean up the ship or their tools by dunking them into vats of benzene. And we know that's associated with developing it. You know, I don't know. I know for the World Trade Center people that were exposed and the people that helped clean up the site, there are sites, there are funds established, and there have been a lot of diseases associated with that cleanup. A lot of them are lung diseases. It wouldn't surprise me if leukemia eventually is shown to be associated with that as well. Mm-hmm. But I, from what I understand, most of the damage has been inhalation of the dust and stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay. There are rare diseases that usually manifest, you know, when in the pediatric situation, like Fanconi's anemia, Shwachman-Diamond syndrome. They can lead to also mild dysplasia.
Can I ask another question? How does something like Fanconi's anemia relate to or in any way cause MDS?
Well, they have different genetic abnormalities underlying that can impact on the blood system. And those, eventually, those abnormalities may. Those cells that have those abnormalities might acquire additional abnormalities, like a double hit type of thing, until finally, you know, AML, leukemia, or MDS may evolve from a Fanconi's anemia situation. They have trouble, you know, fixing their DNA. And so if they get any insult, they're more prone to not having that repaired properly, and then that damaged cell, if it's not taken out of circulation, can eventually become cancer. So that's why those diseases are more prone to developing leukemias. So, you know, I did sort of talk about this already a little bit. So mild dysplasia, it's sort of counterintuitive if you look at what the bone marrow environment looks like. So I keep talking about bone marrow. Bone marrow is the cavity inside your long bones, mainly your hips and your sternum, and that's where blood cell formation occurs and blood cell development occurs. And stem cells stay in the bone marrow and they go through X number of steps until they become differentiated or grown up enough to be released from the bone marrow into the blood. So what we see in the blood is only the mature blood cells that are ready to do their functions. They're ready to fight infections, they're ready to stop bleeding, they're ready to carry oxygen and to help you to breathe. So what happens in mild dysplasia, we'll see, for the most part, very low blood counts in the periphery, and your circulating blood cells are very low. But when we'll look at the bone marrow, it might be very cellular, meaning filled with a lot of cells. But these cells are working, but they're just not able to sort of get to where they need to be. So it's sort of a problem of developing mature, functional blood cells. So the bone marrow environment in mild dysplasia may be very packed, but it's packed with cells that have little utility to do the function that they need to do. And they never really emerge from the bone marrow. They sort of die off in that setting. Myeloid, you know, white blood cell diseases, particularly in adults, there's a lot of overlap between, I talked about mild dysplasia being sort of a precursor to acute leukemia in some patients, And that's why myelodysplasia has been called historically like pre-leukemia or smoldering leukemia. You may have heard these terms. And that's because doctors way back when, they noticed that people that had these low blood counts, a certain proportion of them inevitably developed acute leukemia. There's also another type of chronic myeloid or white blood cell problem called the myeloproliferative disorders. You may have heard of these as well. So myeloproliferative disorders are just like the name sounds like, or it is. I mean, they're white blood cells that proliferate too much, right? Myelodysplasia, the cells are dysplastic, and dysplastic just means that they don't look normal, all right? So you have cells that don't look more normal, you have syndromes where the cells grow too much, and then you have the third category, which is acute leukemia. So those three subsets or categories of white cell problems can overlap. So you may have myelodysplasia, but you may have some characteristics of a myeloproliferative disorder as well. And you may have an MDS, myelodysplastic syndrome, and you may evolve into acute leukemia. Get treated for acute leukemia and get knocked back into myelodysplasia. So my point is there's sort of some people may have characteristics of different categories of these white blood cell problems, and they need different treatments at different times. But in the end, it's the stem cell that's abnormal, and it's giving rise to this abnormal blood counts. So this is sort of, if you can understand this is essentially blood cell formation. This is sort of a simple diagram, and this is the stem cell that I've been talking about, that is able to give rise eventually to all the different types of white blood cells that you require during your lifetime. In MDS, this stem cell is damaged or it has mutations, so it does not fulfill its mission to recapitulate all these different types of blood cells. So the stem cell can go down different pathways and become red cells, become platelets, become the white cells that fight infection day to day, minute to minute, and it also can function as to differentiate down the more smart immune system side, the lymphoid compartment. So as you can see, if you sort of take this cell out, or if that cell is damaged, you're going to eventually not have these end products, the red cells, the platelets, or the white blood cells. And this whole process may take a couple weeks for red cells. It may take a few months to make it may take a couple of weeks to make white blood cells. It takes several months to make red blood cells, and platelets also takes probably more like 3 to 5 weeks. So if there's an interruption in this pathway, in this factory, there's going to be a lag where there's not going to be any end products made, just like in a factory. If you shut down the factory for a certain period of time and it takes 3 weeks to make something, when you start it back up, you're going to have to wait 3 weeks before you see the end products. So a lot of the therapies that we do will sort of intervene into this process, the malignant process, and try to reset everything so that red blood cells now can be made. And that's why during chemotherapy you might see your counts go down maybe 2 weeks after treatment, and then by the time for the next cycle, 4 weeks, your blood cells will be back up. And that's because it takes a certain amount of time to make white blood cells and to make platelets. So what, you know, the signs and symptoms of having myelodysplasia, people here may have experienced these things, but it's good to know or be aware of what may happen. So these are essentially the top three, for the most part, are signs of anemia. So if your red cells are low, you're going to feel tired. You're going to feel draggy. You know, you'll feel no energy, or at least less energy for the things that you used to do. People will say, oh, I used to walk 5 miles a day. Now I have trouble walking 1 mile. That's because your body's not able to get enough oxygen to the tissues because the red cells are low. You can be pale, mainly around your eyes. That's a sign of anemia. You can have palpitations or be conscious of your heart beating because your heart is trying to circulate more blood because the tissues are needing more and more oxygen that they're not getting. Shortness of breath. associated with anemia. There could be increased risks of bruising or bleeding, and that's a sign that your platelets are low. We talked about platelets are the type of cells that are constantly consumed in your body, plugging up little defects in your blood vessels. So if you get something like you hit your hand or you get a cut, it may bleed more, or your bruise may be more extensive because the platelets are low and they're not stopping that bleeding process. And then, if I get this, and last one is infection, and that's really the main function of the white blood cells. I mean, they go around, they gobble up bacteria, they make their way into your body, or they'll get rid of whatever other invaders it might be. So white blood cells are important because they don't just circulate in your blood, they're also present outside your bloodstream. So I always tell people that you're sort of prone to fevers when your white blood cells go low because, you know, your white blood cells, sometimes they leave the blood vessels and they line your intestines. And in your intestines, you know, you have this own microbiological flora. You have bacteria in your gut to help you digest food, right? So normally, these bacteria in your gut, they normally sort of leak through the spaces in between cells and make their way into the bloodstream. But usually, one sec. Usually there's that wall of white cells that's there and that gobbles up bacteria that might get that far. So you never end up with an infection, you never end up with a fever. So you take away those white blood cells either from chemotherapy or from no production because of myelodysplasia, these bacteria can sort of leak into your bloodstream, give people fever, give people infections like bacteremia. Yeah, the question?
Yeah. How does a hematologist draw a fine line between being exacting concerning shortness of respiratory activity being related to anemia versus a heart condition?
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And also, the two slides before this, you kept talking about myeloproliferative diseases and white blood cells, but in terms of dysplastic, you said they aren't formed or shaped properly, but you're talking in that case about red blood cells, right? Not white blood cells.
No, it can be both. All three of them don't look normal.
Oh,
so the white
three.
Blood cells don't look or don't act normally, and the platelets also don't look normal.
Uh-huh.
So in an individual, you may have one or all of them involved.
Okay.
You know, and it is sometimes it's difficult to differentiate, because these are diseases that happen more in older people. They may already have had heart problems before. So we have to look at the whole picture and what the patient or the individual will tell me, and I'll know objectively what his or her hemoglobin is. And if it's normally 12 and they come in and it's 7, then it's probably due to the anemia. But, you know, that's why, you know, myelodysplasia, because it is more prevalent as you get older, people usually acquire some medical problems along the way, and it's a little bit more difficult to treat individuals that may have underlying heart disease because they may not tolerate the same level of hemoglobin or red cells.
At Rutgers, what is the sort of guideline for concept of transfusion or not in terms of the number of hemoglobin or hematocrit or whatever?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of, a lot of it is individualized. You know, it's individualized also from the attending, from the doctor side. If somebody has heart problems and they have angina, when their red cells get below 8, they're going to get blood. So myelodysplasia, I look at it myself, I may be a little bit more lenient, but it's a disease that we're trying to treat day to day. Ultimately, most transplant is what is only curative measure, but not a lot of people are candidates because of their age or because of their underlying medical things. So, you know, keeping people supportive and keeping them active with their activities that they want to do, that's really the underlying thing for me. So if they require a hemoglobin over 7 or over 8, that's what we'll do. Okay? Well, that's what I'll do. We did talk about this. That was a very good segue, I have to know. That covered the first point here. The second point, in terms of infection, Some white cells level, you know, too low, and you may be predisposed to having more infections. So we have, I mentioned on the previous slide where it was that diagram with the different types of white blood cells. We're interested most in the neutrophil count, which is the white blood cells that go around gobbling up the bacteria. So we can take the total white count and multiply that by the percentage of granulocytes or neutrophils and come up with a number called an ANC. Has anybody heard about ANC number? Absolute neutrophil count? That's sort of a barometer that we use, that we know that a person's ANC should be over 1,000, right? That means that they have at least 1,000 of these infection-fighting cells available all the time. When that number goes below 1,000, people are more predisposed to getting infections, usually from within, like I mentioned before, something leaking from your gut. When that ANC number gets below 500, people are at a much higher level or risk of infection. So those are sort of key numbers to sort of keep in mind. And if somebody is chronically below an ANC of 500, they may have more or very frequent infections like bronchitis or pneumonias or skin infections. And those individuals most likely would need treatment earlier than other people, obviously, that don't have infections, because we would want to get those white cells up if we can. And thrombocytopenia is just a fancy name for low platelets. Puts you at a risk for higher bleeding. I can't give you an absolute number on what platelet number is required to keep you safe from bleeding. Most places will transfuse, depending on the situation, either when the platelet count gets below 20,000 or even below 10,000. So if people are fine and they're not having issues with fever or infections, we may let the platelets go to around 10,000. But we'll give you platelets if it goes below 10. Yes?
Are you familiar with the lichen planus?
A little bit.
Immune disease type thing. Does that have anything to do with this ANC low count?
I think probably not in terms of the bacterial infection-fighting cells, but the treatment for the autoimmune problems and people that have an autoimmune dysregulation in their body, they seem to be more predisposed to developing things like mild dysplasia. Because your immune system doesn't just keep you safe from infections. It's always looking at your cells and what looks like you and what doesn't look like you. And when it doesn't have that immune recognition intact, like in an autoimmune situation, we tend to see people developing things like mild dysplasia or different other cancers that might otherwise be eradicated by an immune system that's totally functioning online.
I'm curious whether the MDS is causing the lichen planus.
Well, they can be associated. So I'll talk a little bit about it. There are some myelodysplastic syndromes that are associated with a lot of autoimmune problems, such as that. Autoimmune thyroiditis, problems with their kidneys, rashes like that. So there are a subset of myelodysplastic syndromes that are very autoimmune prone. And they respond to autoimmune treatment, too.
What does ANC stand for?
Absolute neutrophil count. Yeah. There'll be a test at the end. Remember, get that down. Well, that 0.5 is the total white count, and that's gonna be, if you see on a differential on a white blood cell count, it says WBCs, it'll say whatever number, 1, and then if they look at it under a microscope, they might say 70% segmented cells, so it would be 1 × 70%, so it would be 700. I think you have to hold it down. Yeah, there you go.
So when it's below 500, should you be on daily antibiotics? Because there's a lot of conflicting feedback that we get from the medical profession if you should be on daily antibiotics or not.
Yeah, again, I think that's a very individualized situation because there's benefits to both. So if somebody has a repeated infection, you know, like a repeated skin infection or a recurrent infection in their blood, they may have to be on antibiotics. But as a physician, we don't like people to be on antibiotics all the time because, you know, eventually we worry about you developing a resistance to that antibiotic and selecting out bacteria that we won't be able to treat as well, you know, and opening up other infections. So it's really an individual thing. Some people need it. You know, myself, I'm kind of hardline about it. I don't give it unless it has, you know, I really have to, because I worry about resistance and I worry about, you know, having everything at my disposal later on. Okay. Anything else? And pancytopenia, as you can imagine, is just everything is low. Red cells, platelets, and white cells. So how do we diagnose an individual with MDS? You know, physical examination is always important no matter what you're coming in to see your doctor for. And then that just doesn't mean us listening to your heart and lungs. It means, you know, talking to the doctor and, you know, asking specific questions and relaying what you're feeling. That's very important. And that helps us sort of dictate, you know, what you may need. You know, what's a good level of red cells for you and so on and so forth. Obviously, the blood count's important. We'll see if there's abnormalities there. And then the litmus test is really the bone marrow biopsy and aspiration. And that's where we're actually looking at the environment, the bone marrow cavity, where blood cell formation is happening. You know, and I know some people know me here, and I always say, you know, why do we do bone marrow biopsies? You know, ask like, why did Willie Loman rob banks, right? Because that's where the money is. Because that's where we see where everything is developing. And we get a picture way before what we see in the blood. And there's other molecular tests that I'll talk about a little bit. All right, so we talked about some of these things. I want to make sure I don't go through over. So we talk about mild dysplasia as having that element of dysplasia or just not looking normal under the microscope. That's very important, and that may involve just one lineage of cells. It may be just the red cells, or maybe just the platelets, or it may be all the blood cells in the bone marrow just not looking normal. And then there's cells that, you'll hear this all the time, blast cells, you know. Blast cells overall, you know, sort of have a negative connotation, but blast cells are, you know, contain those stem cells that I had on the one figure. Those are the immature cells that are able to give rise to all the different blood cells that you need. So you need to have some blast cells, but when the number gets to be too high, that's a more of a pathologic situation. So you shouldn't have more than 5% blasts in your bone marrow at any one time. And we shouldn't really see blasts floating around in your bloodstream. That's usually an indication that something's going on in the bone marrow. Or maybe you have a really big infection, but that's not the typical situation. So blasts are something that we quantitate and we're very interested in. We'll talk about that a little bit more. That's one of the criteria that helps stratify or figure out what your prognostic situation is going to be from the beginning. We talked about dysplasia, and then we talk about chromosomes. So everybody has, you know, 46 chromosomes in each cell. Somatic cells, day-to-day cells, you get half the complement from one parent, half the complement from the other. So we know what these 46 chromosomes look like. There should be 23 pairs, right? The pathologists are able to tell which ones are broken, and sometimes they're broken and they're deleted and they're lost, or sometimes they're added onto another chromosome. But these make up abnormalities that we quantitate, and the more of them you have, the more serious your mild dysplasia is. So if you have usually two or more of these chromosome abnormalities, we call that more complex. And that's you know, a more serious prognostic sign. So we're starting to accumulate now some of the characteristics that we're gonna pay attention to now, right? When we figure out how you're diagnosed and what's ahead of us and how what treatment we're going to need. Do we need to do treatment now? These type of things. So we got blast percentage, we have dysplasia, how many cell lines are involved, and now we have more molecular stuff, chromosomal abnormalities. So I try to explain to people when I talk about myelodysplasia that, you know, it's not just one disease. You know, a lot of times the diseases don't read the book. They don't fit right in one category. It's sort of a blurred boundary between different categories of myelodysplasia. So on one end, you have people that have low-risk disease. And what do you mean by low-risk disease? That looks like somebody that might just have an isolated low red cells. They might just be anemic, and they might need just to have their red cells propped up. And they may not have any cytogenetic abnormalities, and their platelets might be fine, and their white cells might be fine. So that would be more of a low-risk situation. And most of the people that are diagnosed at low risk have, you know, less than 5% blasts. So a lot of people will stay there, sometimes all the time, and or else they'll very slowly progress to the more high-risk side. So some low-risk patients will stay here at low risk their whole lives. These are the patients that might have not so many cells in their bone marrow. We'll call that hypoplastic. They might have more autoimmune sequelae or side effects, and they may respond to more immune-mediated therapy. But for everybody else, if you present somewhere along this line, we could sort of figure out where you're at, and that sort of will determine the rate at which you may progress to a more higher risk disease. And the highest risk disease that you have is AML, and that's sort of the rightmost progression of myelodysplasia. Question?
Yes, you said some of the low risk people would respond better to immunotherapy. What did you have in mind?
No, some people, just a category of them, you know, a minority of them. So if they have certain things like their bone marrow doesn't look very cellular, they may have no chromosomal abnormalities. Those people may be worth a trial on immune therapy because this, they're similar to the other immunologically related bone marrow problem, aplastic anemia. So aplastic anemia, there's no cells in the bone marrow, but it's not cancer really. And it's the immune system sort of knocking off the blood cell precursors. So there are some subsets of myelodysplasia that look more like aplastic anemia than regular myelodysplasia. And that group of patients may respond to treatment like aplastic anemia treatment. Like aplastic anemia treatment, immune suppressive therapy. Uh-huh. Okay. Right? It's not a lot of people. And so what causes, you know, the progression or makes you more high risk is the increasing blast percentage, the presence in the number of specific molecular and cytogenetic abnormalities, and the number and the depth of how low your blood counts are. So that sort of constitutes your risk going forward. We did talk about this a little bit, the historic characterization of smoldering leukemia, pre-leukemia. The next categorization was this French-American British FAB working group classification. I still sort of use this to explain it to patients, mainly because it's sort of more simple than the newer classification from the WHO. And it sort of makes it a little bit easier to understand. So if you have just anemia, like I mentioned before, that's low-risk disease, so we call that refractory anemia. You can have refractory anemia with these cellular forms called sideroblasts. That just means they have iron deposits in their cytoplasm. That's also thought to be a more favorable disease. As you start to progress, you start to get more blasts than normal. So the first category up is RA. Refractory anemia with excess blast type 1, and that's blasts above 5%, and I think it goes up to 10%. And then once the blast percentage goes up even higher, we call it transformation because it may get up to that magic more serious number of having 20% or more blasts in your bone marrow, and that's consistent with acute leukemia. Although the myelodysplasia field may consider up to 30% blast still myelodysplasia. But it's sort of, as you can imagine, these things are all sort of connected. And it's really more representative of a transformation to acute leukemia. And then CMML is the one type of myelodysplasia that's sort of a little bit of an outlier because it's characterized by characteristics of both myeloproliferative disorders and myelodysplasia. So the white cells grow too much, you know, so the monocytes are too high, the white cells are too high. And at the same time, they don't look normal either. So that's one of the first true recognized overlapping syndromes. But historically, it's been lumped in with myelodysplasia. All right. So I'm not going to go through this slide in great detail, but we have ways to sort of figure out, like when you meet your doctor, we have all this information, and you say, like, what am I going to expect, right? Am I going to need treatment tomorrow? Am I going to need to go into hospital tomorrow, or do I have years before I have to worry about these things? We sort of get a little bit of information by putting all these characteristics together, right? And studies have come up with models or algorithms that have been refined over the years. And the one that I typically use is this IPSS-R, which is revised already. Yes? Sure.
Thank you. Yeah.
It's a lot of stuff there.
No, but you're speaking to it. We can't see it.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much.
So based on, we talked about blast percentage, the different categories, 20 to 30% is really acute leukemia. There's different points associated with the higher risk characteristics. And essentially, when we talked about chromosomal abnormalities, there are different categories of favorable and unfavorable. And the depth of cytopenias, whether it's just red cells, white cells, or just platelets, or all three. So you get different points associated with you. And we can sort of put people on that spectrum of whether or not they're in high risk or low risk situation. This we already talked about. Sort of improves upon the previous slide, just adds some extra categories that we sort of add up, and we sort of look a little bit closely on how low your blood counts are and have different points associated with them. And this is the IPSS-R scoring system. And essentially, we boil all this down to a number for when you present. So you may be low risk, that means your total score is only 1.5 or less. If it's over 6, that's a very high risk. And looking at thousands of patients, this risk is sort of associated with when one might expect to encounter some problems. And this has to be taken with a little grain of salt because, you know, these are numbers that are gleaned from statistics. They don't apply to individuals, right? So, you know, as an individual, you only have two outcomes, either 0 or 100%, you know. You can't have like a 55% outcome. So, but it gives us a framework to sort of watch and be more, you know, depending on a person's age and their medical characteristics or their medical health, we may be preparing somebody maybe for transplant as the main treatment. Or watching and waiting, maybe they just need growth factors to help them with their blood counts. And that's just sort of the same thing. So using that IPSS-R score, we can find out whether you're low risk or if you're sort of very high risk or somewhere in between. So based on your numbers, you may expect a low risk situation that you may not evolve or into AML or have problems from myelodysplasia or even dying from myelodysplasia for a decade or more, you know. But if you present sort of higher risk with a high blast percentage and serious molecular abnormalities, you know, there may be on the order of a year or two where you start to get into trouble from your myelodysplasia. And these are the people from like this side over that we're going to start planning treatment. You know, and treatment is a lot closer than on this end of the spectrum. Yes?
What percentage of sideroblasts mean danger? And the other question is, things like SF3B1 or TET2 or TETZ, I don't remember what it is.
I'll talk a little bit. Yeah.
Are they cytogenetic abnormalities?
Those last things you were saying, those are molecular mutations that have been found to be associated with different prognostic categories of disease. The percentage of sideroblasts doesn't mean a lot to me. It just, if they're there or they're not, sort of categorize where you're at or what your subcategory is. So, and again, good segue here. Somatic mutations are the molecular things that are non-germline, meaning that you didn't get them from your parents. You didn't have them when you were born. They sort of came up during the course of your life, right? And looking at thousands of patients that were sequenced, there are some of these mutations that are common in MDS, and a lot of them are also common in AML, because there's a very close relationship between these diseases. And some of them are definitely associated with disease features, including outcomes or how, you know, people do overall. We're gaining more and more information on this each day as sequencing becomes easier and easier to do. And now most patients come to see me, or I send them for genomic sequencing, so we have all these mutations in hand. And this is not for you to really see, but there's this, like, a whole slew of mutations here and how prevalent they may be in different types of myelodysplasia. So the one that you mentioned, SF3B1, very, very prevalent, the light blue, in refractory anemia with the ring sideroblasts. And that's associated with a more favorable myelodysplastic syndrome. Other ones, such as, you know, P53 or EZH2, those are more serious molecular abnormalities. So we're starting to move these things into the clinical management. I mentioned the SF3B1 is more favorable. These mutations here appear to have an adverse effect. Some of them, including P53, RUNX1, and EZH2, appear to be adverse regardless of the blast percentage. So these molecular abnormalities that we're getting now add risk above and beyond the IPSSR score. And same with these genes too. A lot of these are recurrent. P53 mutations are in general very, very serious, and their presence would make us seriously consider a bone marrow transplant if we're able. Yes?
What does it mean, appear favorable, that if you have the SF3B1, you will not morph into AML, or?
Or, you know, may not morph into, or it'll take a longer period of time. And so when we think about mapping out an individual's treatment for myelodysplasia, we have to take into account the patient. So people might have similar diseases, but one individual may be in their 40s or 50s, and another individual may be in their 80s. And those two patients won't have the same therapeutic options, you know, based on their underlying medical condition. And we sort of determine that by looking at their heart function, their lung function, their age, and whether they have other medical issues like diabetes and things like that. That in general they're called comorbidities, meaning they're medical issues that are in addition to the myelodysplasia. And then there's patient-related characteristics that I mentioned. Age, you can't change that. You are how old you are. But performance status, PS, is very important. So if you're not well, and you're not able to be up and out of the bed at least half the day, you're at higher risk for infections. You're at higher risk for things just in general. So unfortunately, you wouldn't be an individual that we would consider the most rigorous therapy, because the performance status will sort of predicts that it won't go well, and the toxicities may be too high. So we always ask about how you're doing, what you're doing, what you're able to do at home, are you able to do the things you want to do, or in the bed most of the day. These things are important. And then we spend most of the time talking about the clinical variables, disease-related and biological variables. All this information is sort of distilled down into a treatment plan for the individual. And that treatment plan will be different for different individuals, even of the same age, just based on their underlying medical history. And yes.
How much of a factor, if any, is high blood pressure?
You know, high blood pressure per se, if it's controlled, is not typically a factor. Even diabetes is not a huge factor if it's controlled. But if these things have been uncontrolled for years or decades, an individual may be at higher risk for stroke, heart attack. They may have already had these things, or may have kidney function that's not great because of high blood pressure or diabetes that hasn't been tightly controlled. So blood pressure per se is not a problem. It's how it's been and how long it's been there. And I'm just going to go through kind of quickly, because I've been talking about treatment a little bit as we went through. I do think, as the Leukemia Society suggests, that MDS is typically treated by a hematologist or an oncologist. I don't view it myself as a primary care issue. And there's even oncologists, hematologists that may not see a lot of it. I would recommend that you at least touch base with somebody that sees a lot of it, and at least get their opinion and have them at least help manage your care or come up with a plan, at least initially. And that can be put into play wherever your local doctor is. But that's just sort of our opinion. It's also good to go to a center where that has all the levels of care that you might need, you know, from just supportive care all the way up to transplantation, if you may require that. All right, so low-risk disease, you know, we can watch them for a period of time if they don't need transfusions. We can try things like erythropoietin. You guys have heard of that. In the beginning, if we can check your endogenous erythropoietin, which is a hormone that tells your bone marrow to make more red cells. If that number is not super high, that predicts that you'll have a response to growth factors like Procrit or Aranesp. And people can go on for years with just having a shot a week or every other week to help the red cells stay up. Sometimes we add growth factors to the white cells if there's repeated infections, or sometimes there's a synergy between Procrit and the growth factors for white blood cells. So sometimes that's also tried to try to support people with low-risk disease to help them have the hemoglobin that they need to get through their day. High-risk disease, that's when we talk about, you know, trying to control the disease as long as we can, have them evaluated for transplant if that's a possibility.
I have a question.
Yes.
Going back to the previous slide, how do you manage the disease by reducing transfusion needs? How do you manage the disease?
Well, the disease, you know, we manage the disease by trying to manage the blood counts, right? So we're trying to do supportive care. So you keep people's blood counts up so they can get through their day. We give them vaccinations. We give them antibiotics when they need it. The only curative method for mild dysplasia is bone marrow transplantation. And that's a complex clinical procedure. And Dr. Goldberg will go over that a little bit in detail.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Sorry. Okay. So I know that it's individualized, but for a patient that is, say, low to moderate risk with MDS, what is the interval that you are looking for with transfusions? You know, the time that you're trying to extend the transfusions to?
Yeah, it sort of depends. You know, it's sort of individualized. If people are starting to need transfusions, like, you know, every other week or weekly, you know, that's a situation when they have to go on to other treatment, like the hypomethylators that I'll mention briefly. We can manage people with transfusions to a certain point, and then there's other problems like iron overload that might come up.
From the transfusions.
Right. So if you start to need more and more transfusions, or you're feeling poorly despite the transfusion support, that's sort of an indication that you need to move up to a higher level of treatment.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. So we talked about the supported stuff, it's transfusions, antibiotics. The low intensity treatment I mentioned is the growth factors, the combination of growth factors. The hypomethylating agents are a very key group of drugs, and they're the drugs that have trade names, Vidaza, Dacogen. This is the first real series of drugs that impacted myelodysplasia. And 5-azacitidine or Vidaza is the first drug that actually improved survival with people with myelodysplasia, for when you need treatment with hypomethylating agents. But they are not curative, but they do improve symptoms and quality of life. And some people may respond very well to hypomethylators, but for reasons that we're trying to figure out, people that respond may lose that response abruptly in 1 to 2 years, and they don't respond anymore to hypomethylators. So we're already looking for the next set of drugs after the Vidaza or Dacogen. And then the high-intensity treatment is the combination chemotherapy. If you evolve to more of an AML situation, you get treated like AML, and that's very robust treatment. You have an allogeneic transplant, which means you get a transplant from somebody else. Dr. Goldberg will talk about that. But these treatments do have the capacity to alter the disease course, but they come with a cost, and not everybody is able to be a candidate for the high-intensity type of treatments. And they're usually reserved for people that have very high IPI SSR scores. Okay? So I think I'm going to sort of stop here. You know, there's other supportive things like, you know, trying to lower iron levels when they become elevated, and we have good medicines now to do that, like XJADE. It's sort of unclear whether or not they help how long people will go on, but they do limit the iron overload. Growth factors we talked about, vaccines are important. These are the hypomethylating drugs that are very key. And then other more second-line treatments, unless you have a specific type of myelodysplasia that has a chromosome 5q abnormality or deletion, 5q minus MDS responds very well to lenalidomide. And people can stay on that, just that drug, that pill for years until they progress. And then there's other medicines like Gleevec that's used for other types of leukemia if you do have specific genetic abnormalities associated with your myelodysplasia. And then chemotherapy is just more AML-directed chemotherapy if the blast counts gets above 20%. And this will be the next talk. In clinical trials, also Dr. Goldberg will go through. So at this point, I think I'm going to stop. If you guys have any questions, feel free to ask. Yes?
Okay. Question on the decitabine. So first, I heard azacitidine improves survival rate, but is that the same, or years of survival, I guess, is that the same for decitabine or no?
Well, you know, I think in the pivotal trials, 5-azacitidine did make statistical significance in terms of improving overall survival. Decitabine is, for the most part, thought to be equivalent, but it didn't get to that statistical significance, meaning that it's very close, but it didn't make that final cutoff. But we're using decitabine now in different ways. A lot of it is schedule dependent, meaning like how many days you give it. The pivotal Vidaza trial was 7-day treatment. Mm-hmm. Dacogen is usually 5 days, but we're starting to use Dacogen or decitabine more on longer courses, like maybe 10 days.
Right, because both Hackensack Cancer Center and MSK, their first line that they use is decitabine. That's the recommendation. And I found it to be confusing because prior to starting the medication, I did my internet research and was finding that azacitidine did increase slightly the survival amount of time. So I was surprised institutions were starting off on decitabine, but obviously I'm going to refer to them. But.
Yeah, I think a lot of that might be on individual basis. It might be associated with what molecular abnormality that people have. Because there's more recent data, if you have a P53 mutation or if you have complex cytogenetics, you may do better with a 10-day course of decitabine. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really individualized on what characteristics each person has. But in general, you're right. You know, 5-azacitidine does have the significant overall survival.
And then just one more question on the decitabine. Does that lower your blast count? Can it lower? Because I saw the slide didn't mention that, but can the decitabine lower your blast count?
Sure. Both of those drugs are capable of putting people into complete remission, even with AML.
Okay.
Maybe up to a third of the patients can get into remission. That means no blast.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You said before you might touch upon MDS patients who seem to also have a spectrum of autoimmune disorders that are cropping up intermittently. Is that something that you can address briefly?
You know, if people have sort of normal cytogenetics and they have a hypoplastic bone marrow, some of the autoimmune treatments that have been used that we use are things that we use for aplastic anemia, sort of like antithymocyte globulin or ATG. With steroids, that may help counteract the immune component of the myelodysplasia and help somebody's counts. And sometimes people end up on longer term immunosuppression like cyclosporine. Mm-hmm. And these types of interventions may improve people's counts for periods of time. But a lot of times they form sort of the basis of a dysfunctioning bone marrow that's more ripe for other mutations to sort of pop out. So it's a little bit different than the pure aplastic anemia. Anything else? Oh, I'm sorry. My peripheral vision is very bad. My kids make fun of me all the time. They get away with murder over here.
With regard to the iron therapy, you mentioned something when people get too dependent on transfusions, doctors put them on iron therapy. Can you expand a little bit on the iron therapy?
Well, I mean, it's iron chelation therapy. Yeah. So iron is like a micronutrient that's evolutionarily very important. So in your body, everybody's fighting for it. Like your body's fighting for it. The bacteria in your gut are fighting for it. Your body never gets rid of iron except for when you lose skin or if you're a female and you go through your menstrual cycles. But if you're a male, you never really lose iron. So you hold on to it your whole life. So this in conjunction with getting bone blood transfusions where there might be 100, 200 milligrams of elemental iron or biologically usable iron in each transfusion. When you get up to 100 or so transfusions, the iron level goes up to where it should be like less than 40, the ferritin as a storage form of iron might go up to 4,000 or 5,000. In that situation, we would consider putting that individual on iron chelation therapy without prevent that number from going up because it can be deposited in your liver, it can lead to diabetes, it can affect heart function, but there's no firm number at where those symptoms start, you know. So it's sort of based on the individual, how old they are, how much more transfusions you would expect, whether or not people get on these medicines.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anything else? All right, I'm gonna, oh, one more. I guess you could talk to.
Yes.
I
will email you Dr. Sharp and Dr. Goldberg's
slides. Okay. All right. Thank you for your attention.